Hello, everyone. Welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. It's June 22nd, 2016. And today, we're going to go and build a time machine so that Nick can go back in time and strangle himself so that more recent past Nick does not have to read the series that we read for this week. Oh, Chris, I was so... Remember how gleefully maniacal I was? Like, we're gonna read a bad series this time, Chris.
Yeah, you were pretty stoked about it.
Well, I've got a bad series that's gonna go on my worst list at the end of the year.
Well, that's good. It's nice to have kind of goals and things like that. Before we get into all that,
please, let's talk about something else.
Yeah, I just have
for 2 hours.
I just had a real quick story I wanted to share with you. So I had mentioned last week how I was using Tinder and I didn't get anything. Well, I've been playing with it a lot more since then. I'm having more luck and things like that. And I've started to actually find the bots. And now they're a lot easier to notice because it's usually like 3 or 4 pictures that are all very grain, like pixelated, of an absurdly hot chick with no profile description. And if you ever swipe right on them, when you mean you like them, you almost immediately get another one back, and then they immediately message you, and it's like, all right, I know where this is going to go, because women usually don't make the first move on Tinder. You're just trying to get my credit card information. So generally, I just try to avoid them if it's obvious, or if I just, like, want to fuck with a bot for some reason, maybe I'll do that, just have a bad wacky back and forth, and are like, give me your credit card information and watch me on this illegal webcam site. I'm like, oi, do I have to? Can't you just send me pictures? I'm very cheap about this. What if I give you an Applebee's gift card? Will you show me your boobs? Your robot boobs. Which I guess I just ram. But I had an
It's like when you mess with the... What was it? The Santa bot that was up in the early heydays of the internet?
Oh, yeah. Where if you fucked with it long enough, it'd start getting angry at you.
And be like, you're being very mean to Santa right now. I'm not going to put up with this. So, and then you're like, oh, I'm sorry, Santa. Refresh.
Yeah, you big, dumb, stupid. So I'm swiping through my matches, and I have one that's very interesting pop up. Because the picture is Audrey Plaza from Parks and Recreation.
Aubrey Plaza, yeah.
Yeah, it's not someone who looks like her. It's her. Clearly, from a professional shot, you can see like the text for a movie title beneath her. Like, you can't read the title, but you can see that. And the name is Tatiana. It's not Audrey Plaza. It's not like her profile. It says Tatiana. And that,
well, it's also not Audrey Plaza.
Yeah.
Aubrey.
I wasn't sure if it was Aubrey or Audrey. But it says Tatiana.
See, Chris, if the pro had said Audrey Plaza, I would have saved you a lot of heartbreak.
Yeah. Right. I'm like, oh man, finally, I'm going to do it.
No, she said her name was Audrey. She's been lying.
So I get that pops up, and immediately I'm like, well, this would be a bot, except it has a verified mark. Like Twitter has to assure you this is a legit person. I didn't even know they had those.
On Tinder,
because anyone could set up a fucking profile. So, out of curiosity, I had to swipe right on it, because I'm like, what is this? Swipe right, get a match, immediately get a message. Go in there, the message is, hey man, you smooth as fuck, why don't you take you and your Tinder date to this new fucking Aubrey Plaza movie coming out this weekend? And I'm like, wait a minute! I got matched with an advertisement for a movie on Tinder! Why is that a thing? I can understand advertising your movie on Tinder. Like, if I open it up, here comes an advertisement.
And Tatiana is the name of Aubrey Plaza's character.
Yes.
That terrible-looking
movie. I'm not telling... I don't want to say the name of the movie, because I hate this practice, and I don't want to give him food publicity.
Right.
But I was like, it seems so weird that you wouldn't, like, it'd be one thing if you just advertised the movie within Tinder, like, I open it up,
go
see this fucking thing. It's that they made a profile for it that shows up on my list. It would be as though if
now
you
are... tricked you into seeing our advertisements, won't you go see the movie?
Well, it's like, it would be like if I were on Facebook and I got a friend request from Game of Thrones. And, like, out of curiosity, I'm like, well, this is weird. I accept it. And then it just sends me a message like, hey, go check out Game of Thrones this Sunday at 9 o'clock. I'm like, well, what the fuck? If I want to do
this, why don't... This is why you have pages for people to like. Why are you trying to say that I'm friends with the show now?
Yeah, I could not understand why they'd actually make it a profile within the whole thing. Which brings me to another point. I got in trouble regarding Game of Thrones recently. There's an episode this past week. It's the penultimate episode of the season. Usually those are the biggest ones. Someone died within the episodes. The next morning, I talked about it a little bit on Twitter, and I mentioned one of the characters that died by name, and I've forgotten that Europe gets those episodes later than us. So I got a tweet from Benzai, who was furious that I had spoiled something that happened in the show. And, you know, look, I'm not going to make defenses. It was a poor thing on my part. I shouldn't have mentioned a character by name. I didn't, you know, thankfully I left how he died, things of that nature, very ambiguous. And I was mostly talking about...
died.
Yeah, well, it's you know, to be fair, it was a character I think everybody expected to die. It wasn't like, holy shit, this came out of nowhere. It was like, one of these two characters is going to have to die in the episode, and one of them is the main character, and the other one is a horrifying villain who has outlived his place in this world for a lot longer than anyone would have thought anyway. But I apologize. I'm like, oh man, I'm really, really sorry about that. I completely apologize. You know, my mistake. But he came back with like another tweet that was just like, I'm fucking furious, man! I don't spoil Marvel movies for you! God fucking damn it! And I was like, alright, now my patience is gone. I was like, I didn't like engage back with him, but I was definitely to the point of like, fuck you, you fresh dickhead. So I hereby proclaim that anytime we do a Benzai impersonation from now on, it no longer is just about eating bean burritos and getting diarrhea and tripping. He also has to bitch about really obvious spoilers. We're like, I haven't seen Harry Potter! How can you tell me that Snape dies?
What do you mean the pretty character dies and lay in the water?
Oh, what the fuck, man?
I make myself forget that movie every time I see it so I can be wowed by it every time, even the 50th when I orgasm to it.
I put myself in that chair from Eternal Sunshine, and then I go watch the movie again, and I leave the theater like, oh my god, that was the greatest movie I've ever seen in my life.
Wait, what do you mean the guy in Eternal Sunshine has used it multiple times?
So
I dare you tell me that!
I still love Benzai. I am still sorry about it. But it was a moment where I was just like, you fucking Frenchy motherfucker. Eat shit. I don't care anymore. My Catholic guilt can only go so far.
What do you mean he's made the assistant forget?
He made the most obvious character to die on the show, Dez.
Oh, boy. All right.
And I also like that he put that he doesn't spoil Marvel movies, and I was like, I wouldn't know if you did. 98% of your fucking tweets are in French.
You just go, blah, 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 Captain America, blah, 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 and you'd be like, oh, I guess Captain America did something in the movie Captain America shows up in.
Yeah, so I think next time I want to tweet about Game of Thrones, I guess I'll learn
just
like...
translate.google.com in French. Really?
I was going to say, like, oh, I'll learn, like, fucking Swahili and just type in, just so I can tweet about fucking Game of Thrones and shit. But maybe that is what I should learn. Learn French just to tweet Game of Thrones spoilers to make it clearly directed at him.
Oh, boy.
Okay, I love Benzai.
All right. Enough,
Enough fun.
Yeah. The series that we read for this one, we were specifically told it was going to be bad. I did not think it was going to make me as angry as I got reading it. The series is called Kyo Koyo Hajimemasu, which means something along the lines of "Today we start our love" or something like that. I don't know if there's been an official translation. I don't know.
It's variations that "Today love starts," "Today love begins," etc.
Shoujo series, shoujo romance series, about a girl named Hibino and a guy named Kyota,
but they have the same last name.
Well, as it so happens, Hibino Tsubaki is her first name, and Tsubaki is Gyota's last name. Which makes it even stranger whenever they are both referring to each other as Tsubaki. Hibino is a shy, reserved, old-fashioned girl. They make a lot of notes about how old-fashioned she is. Like, she's got a very outdated sense of fashion. At the start of the series, she doesn't have a cell phone, and this was written in the late 2000s, so very unusual, especially for, you know, a Japanese teenager. And she's shy and naive and stupid.
She's not like the other girls, Nick.
She's not like the other girls. She's
not as vapid as they are.
She's not bitchy, and she's more concerned with, you know, reading and studying and being a good girl, but then a badass, charismatic, intelligent, sensual, handsome man comes along and completely changes her world, turns it upside down. This is a Harlequin romance series. Like, seriously. If ever we needed an example of what is the manga that is closest that you have read that is the closest to being defined as a Harlequin romance, it's this one. It's not as smutty as those can be, but there are times when it can be. So anyway, Hibino is, I guess you could say she's competitive about her grades sometimes. I don't know.
She takes pride in them and gets flustered about not being the best.
Because Kyoto is just smarter than her. He is... Kyoto's fucking perfect in some ways, besides being an awful human being.
Besides being a big bag of fucking jerk and dump. For some reason, he's flawless in every other way. Oh, except he had stringy hair.
Right, right. He is handsome to the point of beautiful at the start of the series. He is incredibly intelligent. He barely even seems to try at school. He's constantly sitting through class, but he's constantly getting the top grades, no matter how much Hibino studies. She's always second place to him. And he is charismatic as fucking hell. Literally from the first day in school, because he, like, gives the commencement address for their class. And from, I think even before that point, he is the most popular person in school. Not just in their year, among their seniors as well. Like, he's a freshman. This is the first time he's set foot in this school, and immediately he's the big man on campus.
Without doing anything, really.
He's just fucking beautiful and smart and charismatic, and immediately people are drawn to him.
And it's not even like that commencement address earned their favor, because it's a terrible commencement address. He basically gives up halfway through. And this guy just like,
I'm too cool for this, and it was like, ah!
Yeah, and I can understand all the girls think he's great then, but all the guys are also like, ooh,
I want to hang out with that guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not threatened by this at all. I'm not threatened by it because I know I wouldn't have a chance in any competition with him, so thus, it's not even really a reason to be threatened.
Why would I even bother trying? I might as well just latch onto him and feed off his greatness.
Yeah, whatever women are discarded off of his aura, I can then pick up those ones, because those are clearly the ones I'm worthy for.
Eventually, so many just latch onto him that Allaire has to occasionally molt off. And then I will pick up their scraps off the ground.
Oh, a molted layer of women.
It's like the most beautiful metaphor that's ever come out of this series, I'll tell you. So, Hibino ends up sitting next to Kyoto in class, and he makes note of how reserved and old-fashioned she is. There are a couple of times when in the series where people call her a Showa girl, in reference to the Showa era of Japan, the past historical era. That's how fucking old-fashioned she is. And so, you know, he's playing around with her. He's literally pulling on her braids like a, you know, a shitty kid with a crush on a girl.
There's a specific way it happens, too, because he, like, turns around to ask her something. Mm-hmm. And I forget the answer she gives. Like, I guess she just gives him a little bit of attitude. Because she already doesn't like him. Because he's the one giving the commencement speech. He has, you know, kind of the same name as her, and for some reason, she really hates his hair. It's, like, made a thing that she's, like, a hair perfectionist or something like that, just because she cuts her little sister's hair.
They make a reference, they use occasionally the fact that she styles some people's hair.
Yeah.
It's not a focal point of the series, but it comes up occasionally. Yeah.
But it's honestly the primary thing that's brought up about why she dislikes this guy off the you know, without ever really meeting him. She hates his stringy hair. And I think she gives him attitude, so that's when he starts, like, pulling on her hair and, like, the just being a complete shithead, who, of course, then they fall in love.
So she retaliates to his pulling on her hair by, like, whipping around with a pair of scissors and just cutting off a few strands of his hair and saying, like, you're such a jerk or something along those lines. I forget what exactly she says. And so all the people in class are like, she cut Tsubaki-sama's hair! How dare she do such a thing? And Kyoza responds, like, refuses to just accept her apology, and he says, you need to pay me 50,000 yen for my hair. You have to pay me $500 for damaging my perfect hair, even though it wasn't very perfect. And she's like, I don't have that kind of money, what the hell? And he says, well, then you'll just have to pay me back with your body.
A kind of
this is chapter one!
Yeah, it's a kind of rapey series at the start. There's a lot of, like, you want to do this? Well, you're gonna have to agree to do this thing with me against your will. Or I'll just take it.
So, she agrees, but her interpretation of paying you back with my body is, I will do something physically to help you out. And so she does so by cutting his hair and giving him a fashionable short haircut. So, and he's like, no, this is not enough.
It's such a weird thing. It's such a creepy moment where he's like, you'll have to pay me with your body. And you start seeing her, like, take her jacket off. And for the moment, I was horrified. I was like, oh my god, is this going to be like Akisora, where it's just filthy sex all over this? But then she cuts his hair, and you're like, is she an idiot? Like, is she that naive she doesn't understand what the phrase means, or...
Apparently she is. She's very naive about a bunch of things.
Yeah. And of course, this also enchants her to him. Like, he's now like...
Oh, now he's perfect looking, because he doesn't have that alpha hair to go with his amazing face and body and mind. So he says, well, this is the first time that I've ever had a woman cut my hair. Apparently his stylist was a guy, I guess, for his entire life.
Never had a female barber at any point in his life.
He grabs her and forcefully kisses her. And he says, in retaliation for being the first woman to cut my hair, I'm going to take away all your first times. Again, very rapey, creepy.
It's so fucked up. Like, that's his mission. This is like his 100 deeds of Eddie McDowell, where he's like, I'm just going to take all of your firsts.
That would have been a very different series if that dog just raped that kid in a bunch of ways in order to pay back for playing.
He just had to steal a bunch of girls' first kisses. Like, oh. How does this get me from going to hell again? It seems like this would get me further to it.
Oh, God. So he does this, and, oh my god, it's so weird. So, from that point on, in order to
get... He steals some of her clothes, too. Like, he steals her ribbon in that moment. He kisses her, takes her ribbon, and then, like, basically holds it hostage so she'll have to interact with him more. Because it's, like, school regulation to have one. Apparently she only has one.
She's apparently a stickler for rules, and so she's trying to get back from him, but she's, you know, leaning up against him in order to try and grab it, and their faces get close, and she gets embarrassed because of the way he kissed her before, and so when she acts embarrassed, all the girls around her are like, oh, what, did you think he was going to kiss a loser like you? Come on. And so everyone in the class hates her because she has disgraced the great and powerful and wonderful Kyoza Tsubaki. And so everyone hates her and wants to get back at her. So school representatives get chosen. And Hibino is volunteered by the rest of the class because everyone wants her to have to do their menial shit and have to do all their stuff. And so they're like, you do it. And then Tsubaki, Kyoza, decides to be the other school representative so that he can then be a lazy shit and force her to do all the work and he says, I won't help you until you agree to go on a date with me.
Yeah, the first thing that kind of gets brought up as a school, like the school representative assignment, is to plan their festival, their upcoming school festival. And he says, quite openly, like, I'm not going to do anything to help in this project until you agree to go on it. Until you agree to go on it. You have to state, I want to go on a date with you.
Mm-hmm. And agree not only do you have to agree to go, you basically have to ask me to go on a date with you.
One step short of being like, you had to beg me to go on a date with you sort of thing. And of course, like, it's not even directly intentional that I think they're trying to fuck with her. Her classmates are just pieces of shit who are like, oh, let's have everything at this school festival. Literally every event possible. And she's like, that's going to be crazy expensive. And they're like, we don't care. Fuck you.
And so she comes to them and says, okay, I did all the calculations. I didn't even get to study last night. I didn't sleep well, but I figured out how much it's going to cost, so it's going to cost you all $300 each. And they're like, what? How could they possibly? You did something wrong. We're not paying for this. And they just, like, all start storming out. She's like, I can't do anything. And then she's like, please, I'll go on a date with you.
Yeah, because she's like, the only options at that point are pay $300 a piece or don't do anything. And she's like, well, if the students don't participate, then, you know, we are going to get in trouble, but more importantly, I'm going to get in trouble for this because it's my responsibility to make this happen. So she's like under threat of being, you know, disciplined by the school. She's like, I agree to go on a date with you. And he fucking solves the problem like that. He just walks out and he's like, hey guys, let's just like fucking stopgap this shit together. You have like airsoft guns, you could do this. And the entire student body's like, fucking this is great, like teamwork, let's band together. And it's like, holy shit, this is so fucking...
I'm fucking magical.
He basically, like, walked into a room and he's like, problem solved. And then, like, fucking, like, tosses his hair really quickly or something like that.
He's like, oh, this was so much better when I had long hair to toss, though. Yeah. God, fuck you, for cutting my hair. So, she has agreed to go on a date with him. There's a really weird moment where, through the course of preparing for the school festival, Hibino starts to actually get along with some of the people in the class. Because she shows that she's handy for some stuff. She styles the girl's hair, she learns how to do a bunch of things, and she helps everyone out. And she becomes more accepted among the group. They stop being complete pieces of shit to her. And at the end of it, there's a real bonding experience, and everyone's feeling really positive. And Hibino's like, you know, Pyoto, thanks for helping out with everything. And he's like, I just wanted you to have to handle a lot of shit so that I could see you fall flat on your face. That's the only reason I did it. And so I'm not satisfied with things going well. I wish they had gone poorly. So get ready for our date. That's when you're going to have to make it up.
It's...
What an asshole!
It's like, what was the name of the like, first guy in Skip Beat? The one... I feel like it was, like, Shota or Shin or something like that. It's the one who's, like, a dick to her every time they interact, but you see how much he really cares about her. He's actually, like, that character, but without the charming other side. Like, he's just an asshole all the time to her, basically.
Ren, by the way.
Ren, that's it. Yeah, essentially, he's Ren, just without any of the nice sides to it. Just a complete
imagine
fuck.
Instead of Ren caring for her and pretending to hate her so that she would be pushed away, instead he actually does hate her, but then comes to love her, and we're just supposed to forget about what a dick he was.
Yeah.
Because... Oh, man. You're supposed to forget. So, they go on this date. Hibino doesn't want to do it. And she basically tries to make the most of it. She shows up in really comfortable clothing. She's just wearing jeans and a really cheesy t-shirt. And he's almost repulsed by her. Like, he starts trying to mack on her when they're in the movie theater. And he's just like, God grief, she's wearing such weird stuff. I can't get into this. I can't get into violently groping her tits. And they've gone to this documentary about pandas. Not pandas, polar bears, my mistake. Because that's a recurring thing. She really likes polar bears.
It's
I guess.
Straight.
That's her thing?
She has two interests in life, Nick. Cutting hair and polar bears.
Oh man, if a polar bear with long stringy hair came into her life.
Well, she hated it first because she hates long stringy hair on guys.
But then once she cut it, she'd be like, oh, it's perfect now.
She's like, no, I know this toilet bear has been trying to eat me, but I think deep down I'm really enchanted by him and he is by me.
So eventually he gets fed up with it and just like starts molesting her and is acting like he's going to rape her. Gets her isolated, pins her down, starts undressing her. And she eventually just decides there's no point in resisting. I'm just going to get really cold and pretend this is all a dream and just get through this. She just completely freezes up and is like, just do what you want and then leave me alone. And he goes, well, this isn't fun anymore. And stops. And after he stops and the day is over, she goes, but when he held me and pressed his lips against mine, I felt my heart beating and my breath getting shallow and my body heating up. And, oh, I'd fall in love with him. So...
so now let's deal with the drama of, like, who's that family ever going to spend Christmas with and other couple things.
So... that's what this series comes down to. I didn't get all the way through this manga, I'll flat out admit. I got a little bit more than a third of the way through it. But this manga just finds a way to keep on coming up with new ways for me to hate it. From the get-go, though, when you start with that premise, there's no salvaging this shit. Literally, he forces himself on her until she likes it. That is literally what happens. There is no splitting hairs with this. He does not actually penetrate her, but he sexually assaults her until she decides she likes it and wants more. And from that point onward, their relationship is basically carrot and stick treatment. He'll try and press her to do things when she doesn't want it, and then when she decides she does want it later on, but he's not in the mood for it, he just rejects her coldly. Even when they actually start dating, he keeps on treating her this way. And every single time that there's a problem, it's her fault somehow. It's not just him telling her this, or her deciding this on her own. Everyone in the series tells her this, that she is mistreating him, that she's not being fair to him, that she is being completely illogical and expecting him to do everything, when really, all she wants, whenever there's a problem, is for him to not fuck her until she's ready for it. Which is not too much for anyone to ask. This, if you took excerpts from this series and surrounded them in dickish instructional rhetoric, you could package this up for $20 and sell it to alpha male douchebags who are having trouble getting laid. And just tell them, if you just assert yourself, the woman eventually will wilt under your masculinity and your authority, and she'll start to obey you and do whatever you want her to. But occasionally you have to, you know, not just be authoritative, and you have to be able to offer her rewards and also punish her for doing something wrong. And if she starts to get assertive in wanting things, even if she wants the same things as you, you then have to start rejecting her to make sure that she knows you're in control.
Yeah, that's the alpha way.
It would be so easy to do that. I cannot believe this manga. It is the most sexist manga we have had to read for this show. And that is saying a lot when you consider some of the stuff that we have read.
Because we've read series before of, like, the shoujo variety, too, where it's a female lead and then, like, a douchey jerk protagonist, and he'll act coldly towards her, but they still fall in love. But none of those have ever felt as unnerving as the relationship these two have. Like, none of them have ever shared that same level of just, like, wow, he's really a fuck to you, and there's no reason. Like, I could think, what was the maid-sama, Kaiwo no maid-sama? It was a similar sort of thing. Like, it was a guy who discovered her secret and kind of held it over her to, like, get them together. That was, like, a same sort of shitty thing, but it was never as like, violating or creepy as it is in this series, where this is the first chapter. He's like, I don't want you to pay for it. You're going to have to pay for my hair that you cut with your body. And then after that, you know, she cuts his hair instead. Then he's like, oh, well, I'm interested in you now. And despite the fact that everyone else in the school at that point hates her, he just loudly proclaims over and over again, like, I'm going to make you my woman. You're going to be mine in the future.
Like, there's literally a couple of points where people are kind of badgering her because they've heard rumors about them, and they're like, oh, are you interested in Kyoto? Or have you really started dating Kyoto? I can't believe that an ugly girl like you would date Kyoto. And he just comes up around and puts his arm really possessively around her, and he says, this one's my woman now.
Now they go, oh.
I hated this manga with burning, hot, fiery, passionate hatred. Did I hate this manga? I am disgusted by it. I am offended by it. That, and it's not just a matter of, oh, as a feminist, this offends me. You know, this is not the way that you treat women or whatever. This, I'm sure, is just to appeal to a fetish in terms of there are some who want people to take control and show them that, you know, it's that kind of thing where I don't really, you know, have confidence in myself. I wish that some perfect guy would just come along and, you know, handle everything and, you know, whisk me away, and he would be perfect in every way and make up for all my imperfections. We would make mad passionate love, but he would respect me.
Yeah.
It's just that. And I understand the appeal of that in the same way that I understand the appeal of a guy tripping and falling headfirst into giant tits, pussy, ass, whatever other body part they have a fetish for. And there is an individual girl for every single fetish. I understand. I still hate it. But I understand why it exists. But at least in terms of all of those series with a guy falling face first into a girl's panties, at least the audience that it is meant to cater to, you know, the guy, at least they're made to be buffoons. And at least there is usually an innocence to them. Like, they don't mean to fall head first into pussy. It just happens, and that is why it's acceptable, and they're not put on a list. In this, it's literally about manipulating the audience stand-in, women who are reading this, and saying, this is how you achieve happiness. It's by simply subjecting yourself to the man. Because you'll totally get a perfect guy if you just remain faithful, you keep your head down, you do everything that he says.
This stupid. This is the kind of manga you'd expect, I guess, or rather the person writing it expected, like, a bunch of teenage girls to be, like, reading in the bubble bath, fantasizing themselves as Hibiko or whatever her name is, and then being in that situation. But it's portraying one of the most unhealthy kinds of relationships out there. It's a terrible series in basically every way, not just because of that, but there's really nothing redeeming about it. It's not a funny series. And it isn't as though Hibiki herself is, like, a compelling character. Like, she's kind of flat and boring for the most part of the series.
Like, as much as I want to feel bad for this character, because a lot of shit happens to her, it's really hard to sympathize with her. Because she's such a doormat. And everything that is meant to make her appealing, I don't get. Her obsession with polar bears, who cares? Her thing with cutting hair doesn't really have a point to it. She just occasionally has an important haircut scene. And her constant blaming herself for stuff. And then every single time she has doubts about stuff, being belittled about it. Everything that she does is wrong in terms of how people perceive it. Or if she comes to a conclusion that they do agree with, then I hate it. Ugh. I can't believe that it's so difficult. It should not be so hard to sympathize with a girl who gets nearly raped as many times as she does. It happens a lot. And it's just kind of passed over. She...
Because the later parts of the series are about them being a couple. Mm. Like, I made a joke about it, but it is literally a chapter about spending her first Christmas with him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's... It just goes beyond the point of, like, oh, I'm a complete shithead to you, and it's like, I'm gonna be a shithead to you in this relationship where we now have to deal with relationship issues. But forget the fact that it was a lot of, like, sexual assault and things like that that got us to this point.
I guess I'll try and, like, keep going through, like, here is how things escalate between them. Because, like I said, the series keeps finding... there is not a single turn the series takes that I didn't immediately go, what the fuck, and then have to stop reading for a bit. That's why I got only a third of the way through the series, because I could not go on an extensive streak of reading it. And it was, there was never a point where I was like, okay, let me try reading it a bit more, where 10 minutes later I was not going, this is a piece of shit series. It kept on finding ways to surprise me. So, their first date is over. Now she's in love with him. She's got a little sister, Sakura, who comes to the school one day. She sees Kyota, and he is perfect and wonderful and handsome. So she gets a crush on him. Understandable. She doesn't know what the guy's really like. He hasn't treated her badly. Now, instead of Hibino getting protective of her sister because, you know, Kyota's a piece of shit and a rapist, she gets jealous of Sakura. Sakura is talking to her about how, like, oh, I'm going to try really hard and study so I can get into your high school. I'm setting my sights on Kyota-san, and I'm gonna be his girlfriend. And instead of being like, no, I can't let that happen. He'll hurt her. She goes, oh, no, they're going to end up together. No, I don't want that to happen.
That's the most fucked up mentality. That's the thing, like, that's, I think, part of what makes her such, like, a hard character to get behind is, like, there's not many admirable traits to her either. Like, she wants to do well in school, but I feel like a lot of that motivation comes from just, like, crappy reasoning. Like, I feel like there's a scene early on, too, where she shits on the school in front of her class. Like, she mentions, she's like, I didn't want to come to this school. I had to come to it. Like, I didn't place, like, high enough on my test results or something like that. And the rest of the class is like, then fucking leave! Like, don't shit on our school if you're coming here.
And also, she doesn't appear to have, like, any ambitions.
Yeah.
She wants to do well in school, but to what end? We don't know. We know that Kyota wants to study the universe. He wants to be an astronomer. And so, he's really intelligent. She asked him at one point, well, why didn't you go to a better school in order to set your sights on doing this? And he said, well, you know, I study in my downtime anyway. I'm just going to, you know, it doesn't matter what school I go to. I'm going to make sure that I get there anyway. And so he's got that ambition. He's got that defining interest. They do a bunch of things that have to do with, oh, you know, let's go stargazing, or let's go to a planetarium, or let's set up this, what do you fucking call it? The light globe thing.
Oh, projects. I know what you mean. I can't think of the name for it.
It's a globe that projects.
You project stars through it. It's a light. You put like a cover over it, and it'll give you a view of the universe.
And so he at least has that going on. She doesn't say she wants to be a hairdresser at any point.
Yeah, like that's the thing. For as much as fucking haircutting came up in like the first three chapters, you'd expect that to be a passion of hers. But she's like, nah, I just cut my sister's hair and some other people sometime. I've never even cut a guy's hair before, and that's half the reason why I cut your hair. Because I kind of just wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm. So, I don't really get a grasp on her. I don't. That's one of the reasons why she's just not likable. She seems like an incomplete character who only exists to pine for Kyota.
Yeah.
So, Hibino eventually just confesses to Kyota. She says, I've actually fallen in love with you. And he rejects her. And she blames herself for this because she immediately concludes, oh, I did it. It's because I did it in a moment where he teased me so little. I gave in too easily. I'm too easy. You know, he just sees me as all these other women that he can play with. And so that's why. You know, the things about me that he was interested in, I wasn't showing that, and that's why. So she, it's her fault that he rejected her. And then there's a brief sequence where her friend says, well, you just have to, you know, look cuter. You have to work hard and you have to look cute. So she gets a part-time job and there's a montage and she ends up trying all these different fashion stuff. You know, being a girl is hard, Chris. It's hard to make yourself look good for your man. You have to work really hard in order to afford the clothes, in order to stay fit so you can fit in a size zero.
That's what I demand. When Tatiana hit me up on Tinder, I was like, you better be dressed up on every Plaza fucking advertisement.
See, Kyoto has a part-time job just because, but Hibino has a part-time job so she can look good for Kyoto. Icing on the cake of this shit series. But anyway. So it's explained eventually why Kyoto hates women. His mom cheated on his dad. A nurse in elementary school that he looked up to as a motherly figure cheated on her husband. Therefore, all women are skanks. And you can't trust them, so you have to keep control of them.
It's this series.
Women are to be played with and then dumped. And that's all they're good for.
This is two women! This is...
When he was six!
Our Red Pill's favorite manga. Because it subscribes completely to that mentality. It's a bad series. I don't think we need to go too much more in depth of every little fucked up thing this series does. I think we could just kind of establish firmly that this is a series.
Well, there is one more point that I want to bring up.
Okay.
These girls are jealous of her because she's staying in Kyoto. So they get some college guys to kidnap her and scare her.
What? I don't understand why so many series do this, too. Like, the kidnap. What was the Boys to Flowers did that same thing, too.
Yeah, yeah. So they kidnap her, and they're going to rape her, and they're going too far, and the girls feel bad about it. Her friend ends up coming and saving her. She, like, plays, like, a police siren on her phone, which I guess sounds just like real police sirens. And they get scared off. So she's rescued. The story arc immediately following this is how Hibino is too conservative about sex. After she was just nearly raped.
It's like...
For reals. Not playing with you to get a response out of you almost rape like Kyoto does, but literally, we're taking pictures of you and we're going to fuck you in this like, bath.
Yeah, had someone not come by with a fucking police siren, it would have gone the worst possible way. And despite the fact that all it takes for fucking other dude, Kano? I keep forgetting how to pronounce his name. The douchebag. It only took two poor examples of women in his past for him to completely judge all women on the same spectrum. Apparently, Hibino can't have that same attitude towards being sexually assaulted.
Because she wants to wait until marriage until she has sex.
She's an old-fashioned person, you know.
And so... But she gets paranoid that Kyoto is not going to remain faithful to her. And he acts really disappointed the first time that they're really messing around. And she's like, no, I want to wait. And eventually, she gets so worked up over this that she gets herself really prepared and really worked up. And the next time that they're alone in a room together, she, like, strips down to, like, her underwear. And she just lies in the bed. And she's, like, shivering and petrified because of what she's going to do. And he leans over her. And he, like, ruffles her hair, and he's like, oh, you're so cute. It's turned into a joke that she's overreacted about this when she was nearly raped for the fourth time in this series. And then all of a sudden, oh, well, she's really prickly about marriage, and everyone around her is telling her that she's being too cold to Kyoto. Her sister chews her out over this. Chews her out and says, you're being really unfair to Kyoto. Why don't you think of Kyoto-san's feelings that you're acting this way? And guilt trips her over it. She was nearly raped! Of course she has weird feelings about sex.
Somewhere out there, there's an alternate universe where this series isn't a manga. In the same sense, it's like an alternate universe then within like a series, like a horror series, where there's some poor woman trapped in this universe with this sexual deviant that she's forced to be in a relationship with. And no matter how many bad things happen to her, the rest of the world in like some Twilight Zone series fucking horrifying twist are judging her for it. So every possible mistake that's his fault gets blamed on her. Like, I've never seen a world come to the defense of such a shitty person before.
And the thing that really drove it home, like, this was, I think, the final straw for me, was during the course of this, she tries to be the sexually aggressive one, and she tries to get Jota to agree to come with her to a dark room so that they can mess around. She decides she wants to go through with it. It's not her place to do that, though. She has to think of what Kyoto wants, and Kyoto wasn't into it.
He's not ready.
He didn't want to do it. So how dare she do that? So, fuck this manga. Fuck the woman who wrote this manga. You're a piece of shit. I fucking hate you, Kanan Minami. I hate you. Like, fuck you for writing this and for selling it to girls who are going to want this kind of relationship now. Or for guys who want this kind of relationship now. This is terrible. Fuck you.
I like to think somewhere out there, she's currently listening to the podcast right now, like in a bathrobe, with like sipping tea, reading Fifty Shades of Grey, just spitting it out. Like, what? I'm such a piece of magic.
Well, if the guy wants it, I guess. One of the worst manga I've ever read.
Ah, it's not good. I legitimately can't think of a single reason to recommend this series. Even in, like, the, oh, I want to read it because it's so bad, like, I really don't think you want to. It's painfully... Maybe read the first, like, three chapters because it gives you a very quick impression.
And then that truck gets dropped on the guy and she runs up with the guy who actually shoots her right.
Yeah.
Or a girl who treats her right.
Whatever! It could be a fucking robot that treats her right.
Happily as a single person... You don't necessarily need another person to make you happy and define your life. You know what? She becomes a career woman after he dies, like he deserves to.
Yeah. Yeah. And
just
she...
Just replace Hibino with an actual likable character and have a truck run over Kyoto. That's how you make this a good manga.
And put explosions in there. Because I need something to entertain me eventually.
In order to replace the hatred with excitement...
I think we may have found...
We're
you
in
know,
a fire-breathing ostrich.
There's always that joke of, like, still a better love story than Twilight. I think we finally found the exception to that rule. This is the one story that definitely, like, oh, man, I take the Twilight romance way over this. And I realized that somehow she, like, sold off her unborn daughter to be the fucking mate of that werewolf in the one book. That's fucked up. It isn't as fucked up as this series, though.
Well, back when we covered the end of Naruto, I was like, well, Twilight was a better romance than this one. But you know what? Sakura and Sasuke, better romance than Kyoto and Hibino. We've got a new low.
Fuck it.
Akisora had better romance in this series. That one story where the guy bangs three women and never bothers to commit to any of them. That was a better romance than this series.
Yeah, when Nami was the one sister who rapes her brother, then threatens to cut his dick off.
Better romance than this one.
Far more romantic.
At least she never pretended to love him. She was in love with that one girl with big tits.
Oh, man.
Alright, that's it. I'm done. Put the bow on this. Send it away. Never talk about it again until December. Alright. Or January.
Whatever.
Okay, Black Clover.
Recap. How did we just slide into the recap after that?
That can ask a better romance than this.
But Varric is not going to be an important character. Exactly. Unless you meant that one chapter or two. Yeah, I guess that was pretty romantic.
Okay. Page 66, True Form. Last time, Noelle showed up in order to rescue Asta. But we actually don't begin there. Instead, we begin with Gaush, who is fighting against... Okay.
And we're recording now.
All right.
Sorry about
Nothing
that.
Nothing happened. Nothing happened. We're going to talk about Black Clover now.
There's going to be... There's a potential there's going to be, like, a really weird video quality difference between that part and this. But we'll see what happens.
Don't worry about it, guys.
Yeah.
Page 66 for Black Clover, True Form. Last time, Asta was struggling against Veto until Noelle and Kohano? One of those.
Yeah, what you got?
The two of them came in to save the day, but we aren't focusing on that this chapter. Instead, we jump over to Gaush. I think we were wondering about last week, actually.
Yeah, I made mention. I was like, I wonder where Gaush is.
He's engaged in battle with one of Veto's underlings, and it's this guy.
Wrecking ball magic.
Yeah, giant ball and chain swinging around. This is my magic, I guess! I'm getting the feeling like Black Clover characters are just, like, different kind of playable characters in a video game. So, the guy doesn't get new spells, he just gets new ways to swing a wrecking ball around. Occasionally he gets multiples that he can use for a limited time or something.
Well, I like what the magic system seems to be in that world. Like, originally it's set up like everything's kind of based off of one of the elements, and then you got like these weird outside ones that kind of felt like a combination of them or something like that. Clearly now it's just like, fuck it, whatever. Like, there's dance magic, wrecking ball magic. I don't know where beast magic falls on this. Fuck it. Just every kind of thing, whatever.
Well, presumably it's some sort of, like, metal magic, I guess.
I guess weapon? I don't know. It's hard not to ever think about this series' magic system and not think about the same thing existed in Zatchville, where, like, it was kind of established that, like, defensive magic was a thing, like, its own specialized thing, and weapon magic was the same way.
Hmm. Well, so Gaush is getting pushed into a corner, and he even notes at one point, oh no, the Eye of the Midnight Sun guy, he actually took out my real double, so this is really hard. So he's sent flying onto his back, and all of a sudden Gaush starts going, ah, help me!
It's like, no, my favorite character in the series is screaming, crying.
Like a little wimp all of a sudden.
Begging.
So the guy goes in for the kill, but suddenly Gaush appears and his eye is glistening with power, and he blasts him with a huge ray. And so, of course, Wrecking Ball guy is like, wait a minute, but I took out the real double. Why are there two of them? And the Gaush who was on the ground stands up and goes, I'm actually gray. I use my transformation magic to turn into Gaush.
Hey,
like, he literally does that.
I, for one, happen to like this moment because, yeah, I don't know why it just evolves into, like, it's like the fucking dude from Police Academy's over to the side. But I do like that Gaush has a cool scene there of him being like, you're the moron, as he's appeared behind him. I want Gaush to be the protagonist.
Also, he steps on Gray's face and is like, stop doing weird stuff when you look like me. They head off, and Gaush is carrying Gray around, because Gray claims, I twisted my ankle in that last fight. Whatever.
I just like that he's like, I'm fine with this, but just change it to someone else so I'm not carrying myself. That's weird.
But changing uses magic! So they come across Charmy, who's still unconscious on the ground, after having been charmed by the song magic. And so Gaush's like, okay, well, you know, she could still be useful, so let's go wake her up. But suddenly they come across a trap! A vine trap! And another member of the Midnight Sun arrives, and starts bragging, ah ha ha, I set up a trap here using her as bait, and my spell will drain all of your magic out of you. And he's also caught one of the priests that they were set up against. And, so they're, kind of screwed, because Gaush can't get to his grimoire. It's been snared by the vines, and so he can't grasp it in order to use it. So he looks over at Gray and is like, well, shit, Gray can only use transformation magic.
I love his way. He's like, fucking Charmy Snoozy, and this one can only use transformation magic. They're all useless!
It's all on me! I have to do something.
He's
on
like the
my
zebra
own.
In this series.
But then he starts thinking about Asta, because of course he does, and he's like, well, no, we're part of a team. I must remember the lesson, which I actually learned from Asta, so this is an okay use of thoughts on him. Annalisa, if you're listening, I'm okay with this. I'm just frustrated that he, for like the fourth time in this whole sequence, is like, but what would Asta think if I failed? Just
you see, like, the red sniper dog on your forehead, so to move
this,
away.
This one is the best example so far. So, Gauss thinks of something, and he whispers the plan to Gray. And he's like, okay, And so he, Gray sends out a bit of magic, and then he goes, and then Gush goes, Domehead, somebody's trying to steal your food! And the Midnight Sun guy looks around and sees this giant, cartoonish hunk of meat behind him. The kind that's just like a wishbone with giant roll of meat surrounding it.
Yeah, like this is what you pick up at Gauntlet to fully heal yourself sort of thing.
Right. And so he's like, what the fuck is that? And suddenly Charmy is awake and her eye, her face is covered in shadow. She's like, get away from that food! And she uses her cotton magic to create a giant barbarian ram, like sheep ram, and it punches the Midnight Sun guy a bunch of times and knocks him out. And then she immediately runs towards the hunk of meat, bites into it as it transforms into a giant rock, and she goes, "This is not meat!" Which I didn't think was pretty funny. So, they have won, but they're all kind of screwed at this point because Gray just used a bunch of magic as well. And although Gaush notes briefly, it's like, you know, I've seen people use magic to transform themselves, but I've never seen someone use magic that transforms other things. That could be really useful. Continuing the whole, the Black Bulls are all weirdos, were rejected by everyone, but they all also have hidden depths of power. Good use of that, I think. Honestly. Because it wasn't just like, and now I've learned my lesson, I'm getting really determined, so I'll use my super attack to blow away the enemy! Just,
they're all weirdos.
Use a bit of cleverness.
Yeah.
Yeah, use a little bit of cleverness in order to get out of the situation. And then Charmy used her super awful magic in order to, and I mean, by awful I mean effective and horrible, to win. And she's still complaining, like, when she next shows up, that's not me, Gaush! But Gray has overloaded on using magic, so Gray's own transformation is coming undone. And poof of smoke, Gray is a shy girl. And the author is like, yes, another girl I can put in weird cheesecake poses on the front cover next chapter.
A lot of people have noted that she is particularly a cutie, Nick. There's a lot of interest in our community about this particular character. Anna Lisa really digs her, and I guess she looks a lot like our lesbian correspondent, Brawla.
Oh, no.
So, expect a lot of fan service. Although, I'd like to note, at least as of now, for any character who looks of age, the most practical female outfit in this series. I want her to be the main female character.
It makes sense.
She has pants. Well, from what I can tell, she has pants. Yeah, she has. No, it's a full dry shot. She has full pants.
Or at the very least, a long skirt, you know?
Yeah.
But it makes sense. She's very shy. Of course she's not going to be, like, wear a stringy bikini top.
I mean, Noelle's supposed to be kind of shy, too. And she's like, where are my pants?
I'm so shy about my appearance! Gray is very embarrassed because her real form has been exposed. And there's a really weird moment where I guess this is Gaush's way of expressing attraction to a woman, because he immediately takes out a picture of Marie to stare at instead.
I'm not sure, because his joke is always just, I have a little sister that I'm enamored with. Like, I just...
Is it that he's tired? Is it...
I think so. Because
he's like, I will recover my strength by looking at her picture. But the first time I read through this, I literally thought, does he think that Gray is hot, and so he's forgetting his dedication to his sister, so he takes out a picture in order to regain it? It was just the timing of it. But his little, tiny little bubbleless commentary here, I do think that it's just, I'm very tired, so I will regain strength with the power of my creepy brotherly love.
I think he just doesn't care. I think he just doesn't care who she is. I like to think in an alternate world, this series would essentially be Gaush, and he's just being led around a bunch of, like, he's the babysitter for an annoying bunch, like, Black Bull babies, essentially. Like, he's the nanny who's just like, I hate all of you. The only one I like is my little sister, and the rest of you are annoying me so much.
That's the end of the chapter, basically. Just, they're very different reactions to Gray, because Charmy is freaking out over her. He's like, oh, wow, you're you're a cute young lady. Huh? And Gus just like, I don't care.
Well, there's a joke, too, that's kind of weird, because she's like, you're a pretty young, cute lady, aren't you? How old are you? She's like, I'm 24. And Charmy's like, you're older than me? And I'm like, are you trying to say 24 is ancient? I mean, I guess in Shonen Jump terms, that is like, what the, this old woman over here. But I'm like, I'm 27. Are you, would you guys look at me? You're like, get this dinosaur out of here.
Go hang out with Yami. He's the only one who can relate to your old ass age.
He's like, oh, I'm only 25. I'm like, oh, God. It's like when I had to come to grips with the fact that everyone in the NFL would be past their prime now if they were my age.
Right.
Like, if I were a 27-year-old running back, they'd be like, you over-the-hill motherfucker. Like, oh.
Oh, those running backs who graduated the same age as me are ready to retire.
Yeah. The wide receiver who was drafted, Hakeem Nicks, I always liked him because he was born the same year as me. He's already basically out of the league at this point. I'm like, oh.
Who am I supposed to relate to? Quarterbacks who haven't quite hit their career peak yet?
Yeah.
They're too old to be considered young guns, but they're too young to have actually fully matured as quarterbacks and leaders yet.
I like the twist, though, about Gray, because I think there's a lot of different directions you can go. I feel like this one is very much the sense of what we kind of get from this sort of series. Like, it makes sense in this sort of series context, but I guess it's also kind of nice in a way that it didn't go one of the other routes. I guess I enjoy this. Like, I could find this funny, and, you know, it's a Black Bull character you can kind of look at and be like, oh, okay, like, I could see why she's in the Black Bulls. I could see, you know.
She can't function normally.
And I think it's also
transformed.
It's also kind of funny. You don't often get, like, the butt monkey girl characters, but I just like that whenever she's transforming, almost everyone hates her. Like, everyone's like, stop looking like me!
Stop being weird! I kind of went back and forth, honestly, on my feelings for this. Not in terms of Gray's a girl, but in terms of she's a very, very shy, easily embarrassed girl. Because it was kind of weird to have this mischievous, mysterious character suddenly be like, don't look at me! Yeah. When I think about it, well, you can play around, it's now a multifaceted character. You can have someone who, when they're in their comfort zone, they're very comfortable with mimicking people and playing around and messing around with them, but if they're taken out of it, then they really lose their effectiveness.
Yeah. She's someone who isn't comfortable in her own skin, but when she's someone else, she can be very extrovert and, you know, love annoying people and having fun.
Mm-hmm. And there's room for character development also, of course, with her. So.
Yes.
So it took me a little bit of thinking to get out, but now I'm on board.
I like this chapter a lot when you get right down to it, because it's a chapter that's...
Because of how little it involves Asta.
Yeah, I was going to say, outside of a flashback, Asta's not in this chapter. Now, he's still on the front page, along with Yuno, of course. But it's just that case of, like, I think this series is a lot more enjoyable when we get to have time away from Asta. Like,
and all three of the heroic characters get their chance to shine in different ways. Gaush comes up with a clever plan. Gray helps to execute it and shows that she can do some interesting stuff. And Charmy continues to be Charizard, basically.
Good chapter.
She's Charmizard, if you will.
Now I'm just thinking of that annoying fucking bee character from the Sonic games, too.
The bee?
Yeah, Charmy the bee.
Yeah.
I remember playing Sonic Heroes, and like that was the worst part of playing.
Vector the Crocodile. And the other two.
Espio the Chameleon. I was like, this is the weirdest, like, Sonic XP of this whole game, where you're just like, oh, he's a chameleon who runs super fast for some reason. And their missions were always annoying and shitty, but their theme song is pretty cool.
Team Chaotix, I think.
Yeah, Team Chaotix! They're detectives! You are on your side!
Oh, the Sonic games with their weird but awesome sense of music. Anyhow. Let's move on to Bleach. Chapter 678, The Future Black, a.k.a. Did you really think it was going to be that easy, Ichigo? Piece of shit.
It's now, though, an actual new mechanic in the series about, oh, you thought this.
Well, it's been that way since we were in, like, chapter 300-something, you know, deep in the fight with Aizen. oh, you thought that Yami was the Espada Diez. Well, he's really Espada Cero.
Well, what I mean now is that you thought you could take
the Hugyoku away from Aizen and that would stop him, but...
But now Yuubok's power is to just actively do that. Like, oh, you thought that worked, but I just changed the future, so it does it. Fuck you!
So basically, he's basically got the Hugyoku now, doesn't he?
I mean, I don't...
Just he has full control of it.
Well, the Hugyoku...
The Hugyoku could change reality based on the owner's wishes. What the owners desired to happen.
Would that then ultimately also say they could change the future?
Well, yeah. I mean...
I don't know if time control is part of... I don't know how they define a lot of those sorts of powers.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, the explanation that he gave last time in terms of, I can oversee the entire future, so your attempts to change it are fruitless. I can see every path you can possibly take. It's now just becomes, well, all of those grains of sand I was talking about, basically, I can just grab them in my hands and shake them around and spit on them and put them back however I fucking want to. That's the point of the chapter, because basically, if you're reading this, what you should be doing is you should get, number one, the theme from Bleach that plays whenever Ichigo does his big power-up, his big heroic moment, and when he's going through, I know all about despair, and I've endured despair so many times, and I've overcome it time and again. He's slamming his swords together, and he's unleashing his Bankai, and he says, Tensei Zangetsu, and he's got the sword out. When you click to the next page, when the sword is cut in half, put a record scratch effect. And then the failure music from The Price is Right.
It's infinitely amusing. That he releases his new, like, this is my Bankai! My two swords! Hollow and Quincy and Shinigami powers all unified shrink! What the fuck?
And just kind of goes, what? What? What happened? Oh, it's broken! What? Why is it broken? And your box just like, here it is! And Ichigo's like, what did he do? Did he break it? No! He didn't move from where he was! And Yubok's like, oh, that's a pretty nice Bankai you made there. So I decided to break it. Also, I broke your horn, so you don't look nearly as stupid now. Did you a favor there, boy?
Yeah. You're welcome.
And he whoops around behind him and just starts beating the shit out of Ichigo, cutting into him. Orihime manages to block him out with their power, but Ichigo gets hurt anyway. And they're like, what's going on? What's going on? And he says, didn't you have any doubts? Could I really plant traps exactly where you would put your foot down simply because I can see the future? It must have crossed your mind already. And you're right. The future can be changed. That's what you said. The Almighty is not the power to see the future. It is the power to alter the future. Now, don't you lose hope and despair, Ichigo. So, Yubok's super broken. Whatever, he's the final boss. I'll buy it.
Yeah. It's not an issue to me because, as you said, this is meant to essentially be the end of the series, so fuck it. You usually give these kinds of characters the most broken ability you can. And it's one of those things where I feel like at some point, I'm definitely going to have to be like, I feel like you should have been able to avoid that. Because his power was so awesome. Like, the whole Kaguya acid dimension thing. Like, that plot hole right. Of the powers. But, hey, fair enough. You gotta raise the stakes.
It's so hard to make a final villain interesting when you... Because you have to give them a power that seems suitably final bossy. And there's nowhere to go from, I just do things. Mm-hmm. Whatever I want to happen just happens. And there is whatever excuse for it. Either I can open dimensions to anywhere, or I can counter anything, I have an unblockable defense, or I can see the future and manipulate how I see fit. Completely.
It's interesting.
It all comes down to execution. Yuubok has some cool speeches, he's got a pretty nice design, so I'm mostly okay with this, but inevitably, this kind of power can just be super boring. So, I am fully braced for...
This could suck.
Whatever, you know. But it's Bleach, so I'm constantly braced for that anyway. So whenever I see a hint of a positive, I'll try and take advantage of it. Usually I cannot! And I'm sure that it won't be very long until I'll be like, well, this was stupid as usual. So I'm just gonna take this for what it is and say, eh, it was alright, and move on.
Yes.
To Fairy Tail, which was not alright!
Fairy Tail 0, chapter 490. So, last time, Irene used her magic and changed the entire continent. Seemingly, it changed the world. And we just heard this kind of cryptic statement that we were going to be entering into something completely different. I mean, this chapter is called Fairy Tail 0. So, what did her effects do? We start with a flashback to that Fairy Tail spinoff Yuri manga that I didn't read, and now apparently I'm being punished for it.
Where they were... There was, like, all sorts of naked bathing and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, her name is Zara, which is very close to Zerif.
And Zero? I don't know if it's intentional. I don't care. Yeah. I'm just annoyed because it's essentially like a comic book now. Like, oh, well, you didn't read this tie-in event? Oh, you might be a little lost on this then. I have no idea who the fuck Zara is and why it's important she shows up at the end. But fucking, that's on me, I guess. I should have read the Fairy Tail spinoff.
You didn't read the side series where all the characters are cavemen and the men are defeated by the women because they get boners and are crippled by them? Well, too bad.
Yeah, that's irrelevant
now. I have a feeling that one's not going to get referenced.
It's like Kingdom Hearts now, where all the stupid bullshit spin-off games are relevant to the plot somehow. Even the one where you're a fucking computer program reliving the first game. For some reason, that's relevant. Anyway, Mavis wakes up. She's alone inside the guild. She puts on imaginary clothes and then walks upstairs and Zerif's there. And she's like...
He bothers to, like, say to herself, these clothes are merely an illusion, so if someone tries to grope me, it will be naked any... whatever.
Yeah, I don't know why she had to do it.
Her clothes.
Yeah, just say she put on clothes. I don't care. Anyway, she goes upstairs and Zerif's up there and she's like, why are you here? And he's like, I don't know myself. But he doesn't like the cool confident, like he's, like, hand, like, relaxing, like... Oh no, it wasn't me, to be honest. I don't even know what situation we're in. It's clueless to me. That's the scene. Like, they cut away. And we kind of just cut over to a bunch of, like, the various members.
I actually like the bit where Mavis basically says, what are you doing here? And Zara says, well, what are you doing alive?
Yeah. We got a bunch to different members of Fairy Tail kind of reacting to the fact that they're now all in different places and some of them are split up for one another. There's some fan service jokes or some, like...
And Lucy finally reacts the way that I've been expecting her to for hundreds of chapters, which is just, hey, would you mind stop squeezing my boobs? Like, you can do that anytime. I mean, whatever.
Yeah, she's just like, whatever. Like, this happens once a week. I have things to do. I've got a schedule to keep. The one I guess I kind of note is it does look like Elfman gets separated from the group he was with. At least I don't see him in any of the panels. You specifically see Mara Jane and Lasana, mm-hmm. But I don't see Elfman anywhere. It might just be he's not important enough to show. Very realistic possibility, but I don't know.
But Lasana's wearing a fur bikini, so she's got to be there.
Yeah. The only reason I note that is because, specifically, the whole reason this is happening is Irene completely reshaped the battlefield, specifically to move people in particular areas she wanted. Namely, she put Zerif and Mavis right next to each other so he can get Fairy Heart, and she moved Actalogia as fucking far away from everything as she could. So, maybe...
I like this in some aspects. Because it makes sense. It's a very smart idea. Acknowledge is the most dangerous thing. We're going to put him away, and the goal is for Zerif to capture Fairy Heart. They're together. It's like, well, I can't use this ability to capture any of the pieces on the board, but I can rearrange them all however I see fit. Boom, checkmate. It's very effective, and also there's a couple of side benefits, like it gives some characters a break. August was about to go nuclear and kill everyone, and he and Bran just got separated from Natsu and Lucy and Mest and Happy. Also, Mest isn't with Natsu and Lucy, as far as I can tell.
You don't see Mest anywhere.
So maybe he's been teleported into a mountain.
Yeah, I was going to say, I hope it's like Nightcrawler.
Let's hold out hope.
He just got teleported to a fucking tree and now he's dead.
He was teleported into the acid dimension.
It is also worth noting that we do see Brandish in August, and I guess August has calmed down now. Like, I guess she had the chance to explain to him what happened, and she notes, it's kind of weird. She's healed him by decreasing the size of his wound, which I'm like, at first, like, oh, that's like a pretty creative use of her power. And I'm like, how does that work? Like, does she just grow skin around it? Like, organs
and
shit?
I will decrease this, I will shrink this absence of substance.
Yeah. But I do think it's clever for that, and they just kind of know.
By the way, Mest is dead and never coming back.
Thank God. It just notes that August has calmed down, and he makes mention that this is something nobody's seen from Irene before. Like, nobody's really seen her do it in this sense, and she's completely changed everything. So, yeah. Then we get a little bit of Mavis and Xerath talking again. Talk about how they shrunk the landscape.
Fiora is apparently only a 20th the size it used to be, for some reason.
Put that so fairy tale members are more likely to encounter the army. There's only still, like, what, two people? Beyond, is there any Spriggan 12 left beyond the two?
There is. I think there is.
There's one other member.
There is one other guy.
I can't remember who it is.
Hang on, I'm going to keep going. I'll look
it up. Yeah, it's August, Irene, her two followers, which aren't members of Spring Control, and I think there was like a fourth one beyond Bradman that was still out there somewhere. And I guess there's also technically, what's his name's lieutenant. Xerath has like a lieutenant we see around him a lot. And I don't know, maybe that's what they're leaning into. But regardless, Xerath's like, and Fairy Heart is right here before me. And then Irene is fucking like, that was my first time using the magic. And then her crotch starts talking. And is like, at the very least, His Majesty is in the guild, and Akalaji is probably somewhere far out over the ocean. And then her thighs laugh. Ignal?
Inville.
That's right. The Winter General. Okay.
Right.
Is this going to be like... There was a weird fucking winter-themed character in Ravemaster who also didn't show up until fucking, like, 100 chapters after it was relevant as well. Like, Deep Snow or something like that. He was, like, a member of a group that was, like... The other five had been defeated, like, months ago, and then he eventually showed up. You're like, oh yeah, I guess there was, like, a sixth member of this fucking thing. But, I don't know, I just find it so... I get it. She's in fucking nothing, but it's just the fact that this panel literally makes it look like her crotch is talking. Like, the speech bubble is directed at her fucking crotch.
Mm-hmm.
And she's in the castle, and I feel like I do know these characters. I've just forgotten them. And to be completely honest, I don't care who they are. I don't feel like they're that relevant, regardless of who they are. So, she's at some castle.
They're at some sort of cathedral, Lucy and Natsu are. And they're observing, like, wait a minute, this cathedral is close to Mercurius. What are they? This is impossible. Because the band's been shrunk. And then we get to the part of the chapter that Nick is like, why?
So, we see a body waking up out of a river, and it's Gajeel.
There is no way it's not Gajeel with that fucking hair.
Yeah, it's Gajeel, and he wakes up, and he's like, but I was dead. What happened? And he sees, like, some kind of shifting mist, and he's like, what are you, someone else in hell? And he hears something, but he can't make out what it says. He's like, huh? I'm asking, who are you? And the mist starts to manifest into a woman. And it's Xerath, who's like, I'm one of the first fairies. Bum, 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 bum. Dramatic reverb, unless you don't read that fucking spin-off manga, in which case it's me that we fucking have nothing to do.
Well, and she looks older than she did when she was with Mavis.
And kind of fucking sinister, too, to be completely honest.
Well, there's no way that a character can narrow eyes like that in a manga and not look sinister. But apparently Gajeel's alive?
You could say that maybe when the landmass was completely altered, it separated him from the portal of doom. So
from the anti-magic particles, or
I mean, that's a stupid explanation, but it's not as though Fairy Tail hasn't done this before. It's also possible this is kind of an afterlife. Maybe he is in some
maybe
kind.
He's in purgatory of some kind.
Yeah, I mean, she's supposed to be a dead character, so it's very possible he is.
I don't know.
Did die
got,
of some kind.
I don't know. I got my doubts.
I mean, it's 100%. From the moment he was in that portal, I was like, well, they're not going to kill him off. He's going to get out of this somehow. This
two chapters!
It's Fairy Tale, Nick. It's a
two chapters!
Blistering
could have pretended!
Look, I take two chapters over fucking Wendy's guilt suddenly dying as a tragic thing in one chapter.
I'll take it over Wendy and Sherry preparing for death and then being saved at the end of the chapter they prepared for death in.
Yeah, Wendy's, like, big emotional haircut within the span of one chapter when she had her crisis of faith.
Which then immediately was grown back.
Two chapters later, and in that same chapter she cut her hair, the problem was made irrelevant, I'm pretty sure.
Because he didn't do anything.
Yeah. So, it's if it is something like he's stuck in a purgatory and he has to get out of it, I much prefer that over the magic moved him away from death or something, because at least it doesn't feel as bullshitty. Like, it's going to feel bullshitty just from the fact that it's Fairy Tail and it's always saving his characters from any sort of consequence despite constantly throwing them in them. But at least this one's going to feel like it's not going to stink as bad as some of the other ones do, because it's, I guess, something different. And it does show that he died. He just got himself out of it. If that's what happened. If he just got separated from the death portal by the magic, then that's bullshit. And a bad guy.
Okay, then.
So, this is a fine chapter. I've heard some people were trying to act like it was awful. I don't think this was a bad chapter.
I was just incredibly let down by the...
See,
no,
I
Kitiel's still a character. We're not going to separate you from him in any way, shape, or form.
See, I wasn't disappointed, Nick, because I never had faith. If you recall in that chapter, I didn't say it was heartbreaking, because I was like, I know he's coming back. It just depends on when and how.
And the when is two chapters
the
later.
The when was very quick.
All right. Let's move on to Food Wars, Shokugeki no Soma. Chapter 171, Follow Me. Last time, Erina was...
Oh, it's a Phil Collins song.
It's also a begging for social media. Anyhow.
Erina Phil Collins song, man.
Enjoyed Soma's egg dish, had a flashback, now heavily associates Soma with something she learned from Joichiro. And so we open this chapter with her... Basically, will you stop? People who listen only to the audio are going to have no idea why I got so upset at you. So, Erina is thinking about some of the things that people in favor of Central have said, particularly what Izami has said to her. Saying, only what I approve of, only what Central creates, only that qualifies as food. Everything else is mere fodder. And Tsukasa's, speaking in favor of Central. And while she's thinking of this, she is also thinking by herself, no, that's wrong. This isn't right. And she thinks, of course, what Soma Joichiro said, it's not fun if you already know what you're going to get. And she concludes, all chefs and their cooking too, all they want is to be free. This is like the weirdest social status movement ever. So this is the great civil rights campaign of our time, Chris.
This is
let the chefs cook.
This is Shokugeki no Soma's Wall Street. Fucking what was that fucking movement called? Occupy Wall Street.
Everyone's gonna wear armbands. It's going to have, like, the 99%, but the percentile is, like, a strip of bacon and two eggs.
Funny story, I cooked bacon today, left it out into the kitchen to do the podcast. Apparently, Scotia just jumped up on the counter and ate all of it except one piece. So someone went out, my mom went out, grabbed a piece of bacon, she's like, thanks for bacon, Bob, strawberries! And I was like, there should be more. She's like, no. So either she ate it and blamed it on the dog, which is a possibility, or the dog just ate it all.
Anyhow.
Which is a shame. Scotch is usually such a good girl about that. I'm going to have to check out of her.
So Soma, after giving Erina a little bit of space in the last chapter, is like, okay, that's enough. How great did that taste, Erina? I wanted you to tell me in great detail how awesome you thought it was. And Erina's like, I've made up my mind. I've got to sell people's stuff. Someone's like, but what did you think of the dish? You must gather all the students tomorrow so I can tell them something very important. But what did you think of the food? Tell me how good my food was. Oh, and give everyone a message for me. No! Can't give him the satisfaction, which you've been a piece of shit, so he deserves it.
Yeah.
So, next day arrives. We are specifically given a bit of information that it's 7 days until their next exam, the one that all of them were despairing over. And Erina steps out in front of everyone after they talk for a little bit. And I'm sorry, I'm kind of laughing because one of the two guys we gave the douche bro voice is still wearing a sleeveless shirt, and he's like, it's so cold out here. He's like,
bro, man, it's super cold.
Oh, but I gotta rock the guns, dude.
Yeah, I'm like, it's gotta look good for the ladies. They could be everywhere.
If I give into these lower than normal temperatures, then I'll be a total beta. I won't be able to bend a woman to my will.
How can I rock out with my cock out?
If there's one thing I learned from reading that super girly magazine, is that I can get a girl to worship my dick if I just use carrot and stick methodology, bro.
Oh, man. Our red pill was so right about that manga.
Ugh. So, Erina steps outside. She's got a megaphone. Even though she's addressing, like, 10 people.
We're right in front of her, too.
I like that. She's got to, like, assert her authority and distance herself from them. She's such a weird, antisocial person.
I also like it just being notion of, like, innocence in her mind, that she knows of, like, how this would go in her mind, but the practicality of it goes beyond her. So she's just like, you're making a big speech, you have to say it loudly through, like, a megaphone or a microphone, and there's no microphone, so I'll use a megaphone. Like, everyone else would have just been like, oh, well, I'm talking to, like, six people who are right in front of me, but she just has this perception of her mind.
It's like she's addressing a huge crowd. She's addressing them from the top of the steps. She's got a prepared speech and everything. When really, she's hitting some pretty simple points.
I hope it's a Nikiri thing, because if you remember way back when Azami was destroying buildings, remember he had, like, the fucking hat, too? Like, he had the stupid hat on, the construction hat.
So I'm not going to be anywhere near this building when the destruction is actually going on. I've got far more important things to do, like like chastising people for not cooking properly, and addressing people with stern disappointment when they don't win. They're Shokugekis. Anyhow, she says, at this rate, you know, you're all going to be expelled when you take the advancement exams. And they're like, well, what are we supposed to do? And she says, well, I have spent a few days under your care here in this dormitory. And in that time, I have tasted your cooking on multiple occasions. At times, it was shit. But
Look at you, meat smoke girl.
But I'm a guy.
Whatever.
But all of your senses of cooking have a sense of freedom. So, if you decide to wallow in despair, you will lose that freedom. And you may even lose your heads, because that's what my dad will do. He'll totally kill you all. But are you going to let that happen? Are you going to allow that to happen? Well, how are you supposed to do? Well, I love actually the way it goes. Well, but how are we supposed to pass those exams? How, you ask? You just know she had that written down, too. You just have to fall in line with it. With the strength of your cooking. And she gives this big speech. If you have the willpower to survive no matter what, then, on the honor of the divine tongue, I shall support you. Not as your friend, not as the 10th seat of the academy, but on the honor of the divine tongue. But yeah, she says, if you all decide, are resolute, and want to succeed, I will take the exams with you, and I will help you. And if you pride yourselves in your cooking, then follow me! And we shall win. There's a big toothpaste spread as she says, you come and follow me, and I shall lead you to the promised land, basically. And everyone's like, yeah, let's do it. We'll all be second years. Yeah. And Soma points out, I was like, oh, yeah, that's the old Nagiri that I know of. You could have just, you know, been really nice and simple about it, but no, you chewed us out. That's the way you do things. That good job. But that's it. And Erin has thinking to herself as she, you know, turns away. This is thanks to everyone here. I've learned what I need in order to take the first step. From everyone. Including you, Yukihira.
Aww.
Yeah. But of course she doesn't say that to his face because he's a jerk. She doesn't want to give him the satisfaction.
She's like, still like a level 8 Tsundere. Like, she was 10 before. She's dropping, but she's not...
She's helping people. She's just being her normal talk-downy self about it.
Yeah.
Which is good, because, seriously, who wants Erina to be like, come on, everyone, let's all work together and be happy and stuff. Well, that's neither her super depressed character nor her authoritarian character. That's just like...
Well, she's always going to have to be haughty. Like, right, that's just right. Who she is.
But in a way that her character is clearly developed. And the last page is just saying, and now it's time for the next stage. The advancement exams taking place in Hokkaido. That's it. That's
the chapter. I like this chapter a lot. I like that this is a chapter firmly on Erina. I like how, you know, she gets out of the situation with Yukihara without having to actually give him the satisfaction of responding to his cooking.
I really like that. Like, she's got so much stuff going on that it's not that... You could say that she's deliberately avoiding it, but she's such a straightforward person, it doesn't seem that way. Mm-hmm. It literally seems like she's got such an important thing that she has to handle that she's just like, I've got an idea, Yukihara! I have to go into... But you have to say that my food was good!
Bye! Tell everyone to get there! Boom! And I like that she gets a speech. I just said the speech
and tell them solid. And tell them I'll actually be wearing my school uniform.
Yeah, I was like, you finally taught me something, Yukihira. I no longer need to wear my dress and my sleeping gown everywhere. I do also like that, you know, her points are kind of banal, but that she goes out and she's talking to the Polaris Storm and motivating them. I like just seeing that development. I think it's very good for her character. It's nice to see that she seems to have finally broken free of what her father's control over was. Now, this still could change when he's in the room, and I think that's, you know, good and fine if it still happens that when confronted with it, you know, maybe she loses some of her nerve, and maybe that still has to be worked back up. But at least in this moment, it's nice to see that she's completely changed from before. And the situation, the experience she's had in Polaris Storm over these past few months are certainly clearly been, like, have worked towards that as well. So, mm-hmm. I think it's a really effective chapter. It's a nice kind of payoff to Erina, and I'm ready to get into this next arc.
Mm-hmm. And hopefully we'll get to a bit more of that that feeling from earlier arcs of focusing on a bunch of the people in the dorm. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to My Hero Academia, number 95. End of the beginning. Beginning of the end. End of the beginning of the end. Beginning of the end of the beginning. End of the beginning of the... End of the beginning of the...
This series is going to be infuriated at points. All for one, one for all, end of beginning, beginning of end. Like, I hope that doesn't become, like, the naming scheme of the rest of this. Best of times, worst of times. Oh, I fucking hate worst of times. That guy's a dick.
So, this is all about the fallout from the huge confrontation between All Might and All for One. A lot of it is about the world reacting to everything. We get some stuff through a news reporter about how the Nomu that they've captured are unresponsive. They haven't learned anything about the warehouse they found them in because it was completely destroyed. They don't really know what's going on. Men in suits around a table are discussing everything. And they're talking about, well, you know, the ringleader's in custody. But Shigaraki and the others are still out there, so I think we would call this a draw. And another guy is just like, you idiot. We lost the symbol of peace. You know, now the world knows of All Might being weak. The indomitable symbol of peace is gone. So, just kind of driving that home. And there's a lot of discussion over, okay, well, we don't know a whole lot about Shigaraki. And also, he's kind of a kid, which makes him actually really dangerous because he's learning as he goes along. So he's going to get more and more dangerous as things go by. And although he doesn't have All For One backing him up, we don't have All Might. We are less equipped to stop him. So.
And he's continuing. Every time he's failed, he still seems to get a victory within his defeats. So.
So, and presumably, he's going to recruit more people after this. Yeah.
And now the world has seen how effective a group of random villains who all have the same ideals can be.
Mm-hmm. We cut to Toshinori, in the hospital. He's got Gran Torino and his cop friend looking over him, and he says, "The flame inside me has vanished. The symbol of peace is truly dead. But there's still something I have to do." And they're reacting to what All Might has relayed to them when All For One told him about Tomura being Shimura's grandson. And so the cop is like, "Well, okay, do we know anything about Shimura's family? Is it possible that he was lying to us?" And Gran Torino says, "Well, Shimura's husband was killed, and in order to keep her grandson as far away from the world of heroes as possible, she put him into foster care. She told me and Toshinori, if anything happens to me, I want you to stay out of the boy's life. But because they separated him from the world of heroes, now he's joined the world of villains. That didn't work.
Oopsie poopsie."
So Toshinori is like, "Well, I have to find Shigaraki. I've got to find him." And Gran Torino says, "Well, what are you going to do? I mean, if you don't treat him as purely a villain, you're not going to be able to make any headway with him. He's a dangerous criminal. It doesn't matter what his lineage is. So Tsukashi and I are going to look for him. You stay at UA. Do what needs to be done. Even if you're no longer the symbol of peace, All Might is still alive and with us." Then we get over to Deku, and Bakugo actually goes off with the police, presumably to be debriefed, while Deku meets up with everyone else that was separated, of course. I like how Ida is still wearing the fake mustache for his disguise. Look,
I hope he just keeps the stupid mustache.
"I decided to grow a mustache."
"You just got it stuck on your face, didn't you?" "Yes!
The glue is super strong, and my ability to run fast can't get it off."
"It actually worked against it, drying the glue super fast with extra air."
Oh, boy. And it's kind of an awkward parting of ways, because everyone just goes home after that point. Todoroki gets home, and one of his sisters greets him, and she's like, "Oh, we were so worried about you." And she notes, "You know, yeah, Dad got back a little while ago, and he's kind of freaking out." And Endeavor is in the training hall of their home.
I absolutely just love this.
First detail about it is Todoroki has a flashback to when Endeavor apparently was drilling him in their personal training hall. He was, you know, scolding him like, "You can't, if you keep this up, you're not even going to be able to defeat third-rate villains, let alone All Might. Come on." And it's nice to just have that thrown in details, like, yeah, Todoroki's still got really bad memories associated with his home because of his dad.
It's a really complex sort of scene, though, when you think about it, because we get that flashback to it, and we now know why Endeavor did the things he did, why he was so tough with his sons. It was always from this level that he couldn't beat All Might himself, so he was trying to do it through his kid. And now we've kind of gotten a little bit more to see Endeavor's seems to be sorry about it, or at least he was learning it wasn't a good thing. He seemed to be not a good guy completely, but he was obviously on the right side, so we were getting that. But how it all then ties to All Might, how Todoroki maybe feels about All Might, and seeing him just so angry that he can now never surpass All Might, but now he's the number one hero. It's just a very interesting thing, like just how violent angry he is. And it's nice to see that this is a development that's happening completely separate from the main cast. Like, this doesn't involve Deku in any way, shape, or form, or Bakugo. And it's just nice seeing, like, there's an interesting relationship here that's just on the side that I think was a really well-done touch.
I also just like the look that Todoroki gives his father.
Yeah.
Because Endeavor's going like, "Oh, I can't accept being number one this way." And Todoroki's just like, Who fucking cares?
Yeah, Todoroki still just hates him.
Yeah. We go over to Deku, who has just gotten home. His mom looks relieved, but not relieved in the ways that we've seen her before, because she doesn't know that he was involved in this at all. Thank God. This poor woman in her heart.
Every time she looks sad, it seriously just fucking breaks my heart. Like, every time. So just seeing her being like, oh, thank goodness you're home, without, like, tears streaming down her face. Right, it's like, right. I mean, oh, okay.
As far as she knows, he was just caught up in the bustle because there was a bunch of, you know, traffic being rerouted and stuff because of the disaster. He was nowhere near it, as far as she knows. Deku collapses into bed, and he dozes off for a little bit, but then he gets a message, and he runs out the door, and he goes...
Mom, I hadn't finished dinner yet! You dick!
He goes off, and he meets Toshinori by the shore, and... So, Toshinori, both arms bandaged up, one arm in his sling, he's like, ah, you're late, kid! Texas smash! Coughs up blood while punching Deku across the face. It's such a funny panel.
It's maybe the last time we're going to see a smash attack from him as well.
Toshinori skulls and is like, you just can't do as you're told, can you? I can't believe you did that again.
I can't do anything with this body anymore. Like, tries to transform into his muscle form, does it for, like, enough to make, like, three quick, like, air punches, and then loses it and starts vomiting blood.
Yeah, and he says, I can't maintain my muscle form at all. And you still ran headlong into danger, even though I told you not to. You still went and got beaten up. But this time, you didn't get hurt, and I'm so happy. grabs his head and hugs him.
It's such a great scene.
He's so disappointed and proud of him.
Yeah, just like, still like, you're always going to be like this, but I'm so happy that this time you didn't get hurt.
Mm-hmm. And he says, this way I can focus on raising you right, and even though I've been reduced to this state, let's do our best. And Deku just starts crying and sobbing, and All Might's just like, man, you really don't do as you're told. Didn't I still tell you to stop being a crybaby? And they just hug while Deku is having an inner monologue that says, the sting of my cheeks was more than enough for me to realize that the sun had set on the era of All Might. And appropriately enough, this is at night. So.
I don't cry, Nick, of course, because I'm a big, tough man. So it doesn't happen. But this is enough to get close to it. This is a very, like, emotional chapter. It's a beautiful chapter. Like, just the emotion behind it throughout it, it's pretty good. Like, just great all the way through almost. I'm not crazy about, like, the group of fucking policemen who I've never met before talking, but you gotta get that stuff through. And, you know, we get a little bit regarding Shimura and Shigaraki and how that's all gonna kind of play off. But just seeing that stuff with Todoroki and his father, and then this ending is just fantastic. I mean, it's just so much emotion behind it. You really do get the sense of, like, oh, this is over. Like, All Might, the hero, is done. But at the same time, you understand why it was so important for him to give everything he could to live so that he could still be a mentor to Deku. Like, it really drives home how important it was that he didn't fail in that last fight with All For One, that he succeeded, because even though he can't use his powers anymore, Deku still needs a mentor. He still needs someone to guide him. And this is probably the most touching mentor relationship I've seen in a manga in a very long time. Like, I can't think of another character who acts as, like, the guiding force for the hero that really just feels this genuine and earnest. It really is an emotional moment. I love that, you know, he's berating him, he's chastising him, and at the end of it, it just has this great drop of, I'm so happy you didn't get hurt. Oh, I'm so happy. Like, for the first time, it's so great. And hugging him, Deku crying, you know, the beginning of the end of the beginning. It's all just ties together really well, and felt like a really excellently paced kind of series of chapters, you know? It was essentially three chapters since he realized, like, oh, my ember's going out. And then, you know, the chapter saying, you know, him making that decision and you know, the fallout from it. And then this is kind of, as I said, the beginning of the new part where it's him completely without powers and having this relationship with Deku. It's tough to look at. It's very touching, and I think it's awesome. I think it's really cool that this series has a character like this, though. This is a case where it was a much better decision to keep the character alive rather than kill him.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on, then. I do have one brief note about Nisekoi, but it's already getting pretty late, and One Piece is probably going to take us a while to get through. So I'll just say, cool little fight scene. Liked it.
I've heard some people saying Nisekoi may not be ending, that it got a new editor.
Huh.
I can't confirm it in the chat. I haven't had the chance to, like, go through everything either.
I don't know. It might be interesting to see if, like, the story continues beyond the expected endpoint.
Maybe they play it that he does go with Onodera and then slowly realizes he has more feelings for Shitoge. I don't know. But I saw some people in the chat talking about
it. We'll see how it goes.
No, that wasn't true. All right. I'm not confirming either way on it. I just saw people talking about it, so I thought I'd make a mention of that.
We started
up. Apparently, Lucci is going to be in the new fucking One Piece movie. I didn't realize that. Now I might need to see it because Lucci's fucking awesome.
And Sabo and some guy that I don't quite recognize.
I think the other person in the background is a new character because all the guys on the left hand side are just the villains of the week, I guess.
The Straw Hats are wearing way too much leather in that picture.
I think it's an appropriate mount. Well, I don't think
Robin cannot be comfortable.
Probably not. You notice the only one not wearing it is, of course, Nami, because presumably she gets kidnapped by this group as well and put into an outfit or something like that.
She's probably wearing leather pants.
Possibly. I don't know. It's hard for me to be intimidated by what looks like a jazz singer group. I don't know. I guess I need to find out what their powers are.
One of them looks like a wrestler, too, by the way.
Yeah, I thought that was Burgess for a while. I actually thought this was a color page, and that was one of Sanji's brothers on the front, and I was like, wow, they revealed his color spread really early.
So, on the Thousand Sunny, without Peckham's, the Straw Hats are just sitting off, and they're trying to get to where Sanji is. They're having a bit of difficulty because they don't have Franky to steer the ship. So Nami is like, nope, this is what we gotta do, guys. This is what we gotta do. And Luffy is like, okay, guys, let's turn this ship. And like, God damn it, Luffy, you're terrible at this. Although Luffy just has a I know you are, but what am I kind of moment. Because you see from up, they cut to a shot beneath the surface of the water so you can see the Thousand Sunny swerving around because Luffy is terrible at steering it. And they're like, wow, you're bad at this, Luffy. Not as bad as you, Brook!
Fuck you.
And then Brook starts taking over steering the ship. Like, God. Luffy abandons steering the ship because it's time to eat, and so he's like, time for me to whip a meal! And now he's like, no, I'm going to do it. You will never go in the kitchen again! They make some notes about stuff because they're like, oh, can we stop here? No. We're going to go around these islands so that we can actually reach where we're going to. We're not going to just land at each spot. We've got this super awesome new compass that can guide us on our way. So this is our route, and we're going to get there. Oh, but we want to eat at these wonderful places. No. And there is one little comment that I do think is really funny where they're like, we're not getting off here even though it's sweet, Nami? Even though it's sweet? Are you crazy? Monster attacks them, Luffy goes to fight it, and then we cut away.
Wasn't it that we see the other characters reacting to it? So Nami and Chopper obviously are like running away, but we see Pedro, Brook, and Carrot all get into action. So it does also support the idea that Carrot might be a more action-oriented character.
Also, Brook looks pretty badass in that one panel.
Yeah.
Making his stern eyes. We cut away to Whole Cake Mountain.
Should Mark Wahlberg actually voice the fucking French dude again?
What? No!
Stay at the huddle in the city. It is Mama's Hunger Pans. Oh, look, you made it.
Oh, God. They make a note that Big Mom is on a rampage because she wants to eat something and she's demanding a croque en bouche. Or how you pronounce it?
Croque en bouche. Croque en bouche.
And she's like on top of this tower, devouring it. She's clinging to it like freaking King Kong would. And everyone is running away, and she's eating some of the living food in the area. And she's like, no, this is the wrong flavor. This isn't what I want to eat. Nom, nom, nom,
nom. She's essentially a pregnant woman 24 hours.
So one of her sons, Charlotte Moscato, tries to stop her. He's like, come on, if you give us 30 minutes, you know, the chefs will whip up a masterpiece for you right now. It's okay, we'll get it ready for you. And he says, do you recognize me, Mama? Come on, calm down. And she looms over him and she says, life or treat. And they're like, holy shit, there's no way. There's no way she would do it to her own son. And he realized too late what's happening is this weird goop starts flowing upward out of his body. And as he turns to run, she grabs it out of his body. And she declares, 40 years! And he drops over. And everyone thinks he's dead. I'm not sure if he's dead because One Piece. And then she continues to rampage.
The implication would be that she took 40 years from him. So I guess maybe he could just be killed. Yeah. Like if he was 40, you know, if he was old already. I don't know, but...
He stole 40 years from his lifespan.
Yeah. It's an interesting power. I've heard some people theorize that maybe that's why she has so many kids, and she's been living for centuries just stealing the life force. And I've heard other people say that's why everything on the island is alive, because she's able to give that time to other things and essentially give them life.
That's my working theory, is she can steal life from her victims and impart it to either herself or to things around her. Which, terrifying power. I'm liking how we look, what we're learning about Big Mom more and more, because she, you know, that one chapter where she had the song and introduced her, it was this weirdly comical but still terrifying sequence, and this one is kind of the same. She's throwing a fit because she really wants candy, but she's still incredibly terrifying. Even Jinbei, who shows up in this chapter, seems put off by her. And speaking of Jinbei, he shows up, and everyone's like, oh my god, it's Boss Jinbei, and he's got a croque en bouche, and all of the, and it's a living croque en bouche, and they're like, no, don't eat us!
It's terrifying.
He's captured the creepers who are staying at the hotel, and fastened it together with candy! And he just picks up the whole thing and goes, take this, and throws it right into her mouth. And this stops a rampage, because she got her treat that she wanted. Oh, yes, this is just what I wanted! And really creepily, we cut to the inside of her mouth as the living cream puffs go, all we ever wanted was to be yummy! As they're being devoured.
Kind of fucked up.
And then we get a big two-page spread, giving Big Mom a full introduction where her full name is also given. She is the Emperor, Captain of the Big Mom Pirates, Queen of Toteland, Charlotte Linlin. So now that she's calmed down, she says, oh, my faithful warrior of the sea, Jinbei. You know, I was impressed with that poneglyph you brought for me, even if I couldn't read it. Ma, 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 ma. Which, how did we not see that coming as her unique laugh, honestly?
That is true.
But she says, oh, what can I do for you? The city is suddenly fragrant today. Did you do this? No, I just got here. By the way, I have something very important to talk to you about. Did you want to leave me? That's the chapter. On the freaking turn of a dime, she immediately is like, are you going to leave me? After calming down. Oh, God.
It's terrifying. She's an intimidating figure.
Mood swings. Good grief. Like this chapter. Yeah.
Mostly
just in terms of the more we see a Big Mom, the more she's built up as an incredibly terrifying figure. But not giving everything to us all at once. So, good stuff. Alright. Speaking of eating candy, Toriko. So this time, this chapter opens up with us learning what was seen on God's back, which is that every one of its scales is a world, like Men in Black style. Pardon me.
It was a weird end to that fucking movie, now that I think about it.
It was a cool ending, though.
It was weird. I don't know. Like, it just ended and a bunch of aliens are playing marbles with their universe. It's kind of funny, but... Like, looking back on, that was a strange ending. Mm. I guess it's a strange movie.
So... We get some... stuff from, what was his name?
That's what Benzai mentioned to me. What the fuck, dude? I haven't finished Men in Black! Spun ending!
The galaxy's on Orion's belt. Come on. Gigi, I guess, I think is his name, explains that when you prepare God, you must do so by reading the food memories of God's cells. It's a full course meal of planets constantly repeated while increasing the flavor many times over. So, the memory of an entire universe is inscribed on its cells, essentially. So, yes, that's it. We cut away to Joey, confronting Starjune after he gave his big, you know, you don't know whose son I am thing. And Joey's just like, I don't need to know whose son you are. I don't really care. Yeah. But Star, you know, kind of says, well, it's not just me, it's we. But, and Joey's like, well, what happens if I find out? Nothing. But then you would know that this is retribution. You and Acacia are destined to be stopped by me. I don't know about that, buddy. There's another son, so don't count your chickens before they hatch, dude. Just eat their eggs. So Joey's like, what the fuck ever, and uses a technique of flash germ and starts to use her 100 million layer fillet on him. But Starjune moves very quickly, gets behind her, starts attacking her from all sides very quickly with his flame attacks. And Joey's like, geez, he's fast. There must be some sort of secret in his third eye. Yeah. Joey says, well, yes, there is destiny. You speak of the truth and blah, blah, blah. Destiny. You are wise. You have confidence, but that's because you're young, and I will show you your dreams are ignorant youth. And Starjune says, well, it's not enough to give me unfounded confidence, and for your information, I'm not as young as you think. What the fuck is that supposed to mean?
I guess it's implying that he could be the son of someone much older. I'm not sure who he's supposed to be the kid of. So, and it's him and Toriko. So it's also implying Toriko is much older than...
Well, because they're twins.
Yeah, so... It's an interesting little development.
Maybe it's a Natsu thing, where they're actually hundreds of years old.
It's very possible that someone will come in after this and be like, hey guys, you know, I can't believe you big dum-dums couldn't figure out who fucking Toriko and the Starjune's dad is, and maybe it'll make sense that they would have to be older than they'd seen for it.
Mm. Toriko's demons are fighting the Blue Nitro. The red one is actually getting his ass kicked because he can't unleash his full power, apparently. Acacia is still fighting against God because God really fucking hates him, I guess. Neo appears and tries to eat God's tongue, but then there's a flash of light coming in from the distance. And an air can shoots through the ground. And Heracles has arrived on the scene, looking regal as fuck. And riding on Heracles' head is Bambina. It goes, ook.
I did actually think it's kind of a cool scene where there's like a big dust cloud comes up and you just see this giant silhouette, and again, you just see Acacia, like, oh, fuck. And it's cool seeing Heracles, and then, like, wait, what's that?
Whoop. That's God.
Whoop. And then just the monkey shows up and is like, BAM! Fuck you!
Yeah.
It's kind of nice, because these are the two we actually know, too. Like, we've seen these two, so it's nice.
Yeah,
like,
arrive together. And, yeah, one of the Blue Nitro says, oh my god, it can't be! The Eight Kings are assembling! Dun-dun-dun!
Yay!
I guess.
Yeah, yay. I mean, it's something that has to happen. Let's get to it.
War Trigger time.
War Trigger!
You almost said that the way that you say chin chin chin.
Chin chin chin! War Trigger! War Trigger! Yes, I want to!
Chapter 147, Husei, Part 2. There is a celebration in Tamakoma. I actually kind of like this little detail. They're like, oh, yes, you guys did a good job, so we're having a big meal to celebrate. And Jin's apparently been the cook.
Well, he is a member of Tamakoma too, so it makes sense.
I guess
just nobody else in the group's that good of a cook.
Everyone is congratulating them. They're like, yeah, you did a really good job. You could qualify to challenge eight on A-rank squad soon. Which actually is an interesting note.
I always thought they just added new ones, but I guess it makes sense that they replace somebody.
So I guess they would have to actually go up against an A-rank squad in order to take their place, yeah. I like to, for some reason, I really like the detail because they're all, you know, sitting around eating. And then Yotaro and Husei and Konami are all at a different table. They're like at a coffee table further away. And Yotaro's standing on the couch while he's eating. And Husei's just like, sit down while you eat.
That Husei still doesn't know how to use chopsticks, so he like fucking holds like a dragon claw, like,
it's little details. And Yotaro announces, by the way, Husei wants to join your squad. And everyone Tamakoma 2 is like, And Kami says, wait, why? And then she goes, well, just a while ago, weren't you saying, it's 100% impossible. Knock my head.
I love the dedication.
And then Kami says to himself, you were the one who said that. I do love the little, just like, I will put my hoodie up because this is what Husei does.
I mean, he is. He never takes it off.
And Yotaro's like, well, don't bother Husei about the reasons. Backing up his buddy. And Husei says, well, look, I made a deal with Jin, so if you guys help me get back to Aftokator, I'll help you out. And Konami says, well, but he was one of the guys who was trying to capture Chika. He's dangerous. And Husei is like, well, the situation has changed, and my priority, you know, goddammit, is to get back to my home country, so I don't care about that stuff.
I like how ineloquent he seems in these moments. Like, he's supposed to be such a dignified, like, awesome person, but just when you see him, he's just like,
Yuma speaks up by saying, well, he's not lying. And Chika says, yeah, I'm okay with it. If Osama's fine with it, I'm fine with it. Because Yuma and Jin think he's okay, so, so everyone is okay with this arrangement, but Konami is still saying, he's like, well, okay, but you guys are really good now. You've got your new techniques and so on, so what do you need his help for? And Husei says, you guys are still super flawed. She could use that weighted bullet. She couldn't use regular bullets. Everyone knows she still can't take people out. And if she had used regular bullets with that technique, she would have scored a point. And your team's ace is still the only guy who can really make a difference. If he goes down, your team is still in danger. That's not going to change. If Kakizaki had taken him out earlier on, the battle would have ended differently. So, no matter how much better you've gotten, you've still only got one ace that you can rely on. So I'll be your second ace. And hearing him explain things, now we have more explanation of why things went down the way that they did. Why did Yuma suffer that wound only to be okay afterwards? It's so that he can make this point about why they actually need him to help out. Good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and he says, if I'm with you, you guys will be more than a match for anyone you go up against. And Osamu's thinking like, well, he's got right combat experience. If he joins us, that'd probably work. But, well, but he's got horns. They're going to know he's a neighbor. What should we do? And Shiori's just like, I'll just give him a hornless Tryon body.
Yeah, I like that was like a big concern. It was like, I mean, it's simple. I'll just make the Tryon body not have horns. No one really saw him, so.
And no one really knows who he is, because the only people who have seen him were, you know, a few agents who saw him from a distance. Jin's the only one who fought him up close, so no big deal. So like, okay. Well, but what if they find out, you know, a foreigner's joined the squad? Well, you know, one of our engineers has a foreign-looking face, so we can say they're related. What a weird line from Jin.
Well, it makes sense, because they explain it right afterwards when they mean by foreign.
They say, yeah, Mikhail Cronin, he's got Canadian status. What do you mean? He's a neighbor. Oh!
That's a really interesting thing. I mean, we already knew that this was sort of not an unprecedented thing, and that Tomokoma 2 had sort of a status as having the ability to work with neighbors before. But I just found it kind of interesting that they have, one, an engineer, because we don't see a whole lot of engineers. It's kind of cool to be like, oh, he's out there. And it's like, oh, it's kind of cool. Like, there's still parts of Tomokoma 2 we haven't met yet. And mm-hmm. that could still be relevant and, like, interesting characters, so.
I also like the contrasting reactions, because so someone's like, there's a neighbor who works for Borden. And he was like, oh, so I wasn't the first one. Just nonchalant about it. He's like, oh, okay.
He's like, oh, I'm not special.
But Jin points out the big problem, and Nozomu realizes at the same time, is the higher-ups have to accept this, because they do know about Hisei. So Osamu says, okay, well, I'm the captain, I'll take care of this. If Hisei cooperates, then we might be able to pull it off. And Hisei says, well, hang on a second.
Yeah, fuck that.
I'm not gonna give away any info in my home country. And they're like, what the fuck? Didn't you say you were gonna join it? Yeah, but no.
On my terms.
No, I'm not gonna do this. And even Yuma's like, Border already has the info they want. We got all this stuff from Enidora's horns, so why are you being so stubborn about this? Why don't you just, you know, work to get along with us? And Hisei says, well, you already know this, because I told you, but I have sworn allegiance to my lord. And going along with what Osamu heard from Enidora, he says, I don't care what you stand to gain, what I stand to lose. If I dishonor myself by the time that I face my lord, then I can't allow for that. I like that.
Yeah, no, I mean, one of World Trigger's greatest strengths is that characters always feel very consistently written, and it's nice to see Hisei still like, look, not for nothing, I want to join your squad, I want to go back to Efkator, but I'm still loyal to my nation, and I don't care how important this is to you, or how good of an option it is for me, I'm not betraying my homeland.
And he's very upfront about it, because he then says, by the way, if you try to harm my lord, I will destroy you along with your ship.
He's very open about things. I like that.
No, he's not the craftiest dude. He's like a knight.
Yeah.
Very blunt.
That's actually a very good way to put it, like a knight.
So Osama says, okay, I agree with this. I mean, this isn't going to be the easiest thing to get through, but okay, if we both want to go to Efkator, our interests are aligned, we'll do this. So we just gotta convince HQ to do this, and they're like, okay, we'll see what we can do. And we cut ahead to the next afternoon, and all of Tomokoma 2, well, all of the potential fighters for Tomokoma 2 are all gathered to meet up with the higher-ups. And that's where the chapter ends.
It's exciting, because, I mean, it seems as if you can only have three people in a Tryon rank war battle. And if Hisei joins, I feel like more often than not, Osamu would probably be the one left out, since he doesn't have the kind of, he doesn't have Chika's Tryon explosion kind of powers or anything like that.
Right.
So, to me, this is kind of showcasing that thing that Osamu can do that nobody else in the team can. That he's very persuasive, he's a good leader, he has a lot of strong willpower and ability to do the right thing. So I'm very excited to see what he's doing here. It's kind of crazy to me that it's like end of the chapter, like, you're gonna have to convince Yusei, the border execs, to let Yusei the team, and it's like, end of the chapter. Alright, what do you have to say to us, Osamu? Like, oh shit, we're not wasting any time with this, we're getting right to it. But mm-hmm. I'm really excited, because Osamu tends to be at his coolest when I feel he's making a point and trying to do something, trying to initiate change. So, I'm excited for next week.
Yeah, and I'm getting the impression that I don't know which of them is actually going to be taken out the most, but it's going to be between Chika and Osamu. I get the feeling that maybe for their first battle, Osamu's going to be the one to sit out, because it's not just going to be a matter of, well, Yuma is in one and Yusei is in the other. That's not going to actually help them, because no matter what, then it'd be a team of three and we have to rely on one ace.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's going to be times where Osamu, I think, is probably going to be chosen to be the one to do stuff, and then sometimes where Chika will.
Depends on how many more rank battles they have, though, because, I mean,
there can't be too many more, because they're near the top right now.
Yeah, like, presumably their next battle is going to be them against, like, Ninomiya squad, Kagura squad, or maybe even a fourth one again, and then they throw somebody else in there, but mm-hmm. they're right at the top.
And then once they do that, then it'll probably be an A-rank battle.
Yeah. And maybe that's different, because we do know there's some A-ranks of more than three people, so maybe that's mm-hmm. where it's like everybody. I don't know, but good chapter.
So, let's wrap things up. Choose our MVPs. Choose our favorite chapters. I went with My Hero Academia. There weren't a lot of chapters that really stood out as, this was super great, awesome. My Hero Academia got the most emotional reaction out of me, I think. And even that, like, by no means am I saying, well, this wasn't very good. But in comparison to the incredible highs during the actual fight between All Might and All For One, this was not, like, one of my favorite recent chapters of My Hero Academia. We didn't have, like, any bad chapters this week, I don't think.
No, I don't think really anything was bad.
But not a whole lot really stood out as incredibly memorable.
No, I completely agree with you on that. I also picked My Hero Academia. To me, though, it was legitimately a very strong chapter. I just enjoyed every part of it. I thought it was a really good way to kind of end that All Might trilogy of things and put an end to his era. It really does feel significant. And I also just really love the touch of Todoroki and Endeavor's relationship and showing how both of them are affected by this. It's a very powerful chapter. So I absolutely would give it to that.
I'm not sure who my weekly MVP is, honestly.
I'll go with mine then. I'll start with mine. I'm giving it to Erina. I think it's really, really important. It's really, really great that she finally has developed. She's breaking away from her father's control, and it's a very believable thing. It's really good to see her kind of showing that effort towards the rest of the people in her group and her in the Polaris Storm, and it's just nice to see her in a different state after seeing her for months and months on end, constantly kind of depressed and solemn, like seeing that reinvigorated character. And that's the kind of character who I think fits the secondary protagonist role in this series best, so I give it to her.
I'm going to give it to Big Mom from okay. One Piece. Comes off as a very intimidating villain. That's really about it. She dominates the chapter that she's in, and we learn about her power, which is terrifying. We learn about her attitude, which is terrifying and unstable. And that's really all you really need.
Dig it.
Okay. Well, thank you everyone for joining us for Weekly Manga Recap. We tend to record the show Wednesdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, though sometimes we do need to change it up. Be sure to follow us on social media so you can stay updated on that stuff. On Twitter, he's at Rula T, I'm at Y Ruler of Time, and we are at WMR Podcast. Be sure to check out our past episodes on Weekly Manga Recap at podbean.com and subscribe to us on iTunes and on YouTube. And make sure if you do check us out on iTunes, leave a comment or rating to help out the algorithm.
Thank you. It would be much appreciated.
Beat them word workers. Be sure to send us questions to ask for our Q&A episodes and suggest manga for us to read via email to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. Special thanks go out to our Patreon supporters. You can support the show at patreon.com/weeklymangarecap. Your support allows us great bonus content for you guys to enjoy. And, of course, special thanks also go to the people who help us with the show, Steve Mann and Infamous Planet.
Also, a special thank you to Katie Gunn, who is our newest patron. It is much appreciated. Thank you very much. Just a bump.
Chris, what are we going to be reading next?
All right. So, I kind of settled on this one before we did the last one, and I want to stick to it despite the fact that it was a bad series you read. This one might be along the same lines of Aki Sora, where we might be playing with something a little bit risque. The series is called... let me open up the email for it here. This is called Marcielago.
Marcielago.
Marcielago. This is sent to us over by Brawla, our lesbian consultant. She's been saying us a whole bunch of Yuri manga, and I figure it's finally time to read one. However, she notes this one is, quote, extremely trashy and horrible. It has apparently a lot of gore in it and smut. The main character is a psycho lesbian, but she says it's so, like, entertaining within that craziness. So, this could go either way. This could be, like, an awful series we love because it's so batshit insane, or we might just get another really bad series. I don't know. But I think we are...
Is she groping a disemboweled S&M robot with her gun in that cover?
Maybe. I think we're going to be...
It looks like she is.
We're going to be in for a treat. That's all that's important. So... That's what we're taking a look at next time. Look, we haven't done a Yuri manga yet. I thought it'd be fun to do one.
Hey, girlfriends.
All right, I guess those Yaoi. That's the one we haven't done. Sorry, I screwed up. Whatever, I made the decision.
Good night.
Bye, everybody.
Fucking hate you, Chris.